Welcome to Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tuberg, and this is the first of two podcasts this week on which I will be interviewing our featured guest expert of the week, Pulitzer Prize-winning author David K. Johnston. Mr. Johnston's most recent book is titled Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, and very excited to have him join us this week on both podcasts. I'll also be talking this week on both podcasts about a couple topics that you hear in the news, inflation and deflation. But what you don't really hear about is how inflation and how deflation may affect your nest egg and which outcome is more likely. Well, there's been a lot of evidence this past week from a number of different articles that I'll share with you that deflation may be taking hold. And we'll talk about what that might mean for your nest egg and stocks that you maybe hold or stock mutual funds that you may hold. Also, a quick reminder, if you have not yet received a copy of our free Investors Discovery Kit, you can get a complimentary copy by visiting the website investingapproach.com. Let us know where you'd like us to mail your Discovery Kit, and we'll be glad to do that. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. David K. Johnston. Mr. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He has a very lengthy bio and resume. His most recent book is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, and it's a pleasure to have him on the program. Mr. Johnston, welcome.
Well, glad to be here.
David, let's chat about the premise of your book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. It's no secret that the wealth gap in the United States is greater than it's ever been. Tell us about the premise of your book.
Well, this is an anthology, and my effort was to get people to broadly understand all the effects that the extreme inequality we've had arise in the U.S. over the last 35 years are understood. When you have a society where there is a great deal of difference between the bottom and the top, then other things begin to happen. For example, we have higher rates of blood pressure than countries that are more equal. We have shorter lifespans, significantly shorter than a number of countries where incomes are much more equal. Every day in America, because of our unique healthcare system, 47 babies die who would live had they been born in Norway or Japan, 46 in Sweden, and although not in the book, 15 babies die every day in America who would live if they were born in, of all places, Cuba. So this book talks about wage inequality, environmental hazards, access to education, access to jobs, and there's a host of experts from Plutarch in the ancient world to Elizabeth Warren, the great Wall Street investor Arthur Robinson, and others.
So, David, some of those statistics that you mentioned are shocking to me, and I'm sure shocking to our listeners as well. How did we get? I mean, supposedly, we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world. That's certainly
not
the case.
Expand on that. We have a terrible healthcare system. This is one of the great things I don't understand why Americans don't get this. First of all, our healthcare system, Dennis, is unbelievably expensive. In the year 2010, that's the most recent year for which we have worldwide data, if we had had the French healthcare system or the German system, and they're very different systems, they have universal healthcare. France is regarded as having the best system in the world by health policy experts. If we'd had either of their systems, universal care, no out-of-pocket costs, our economy would have saved as much money as we spent on the income tax. And think about that. It is so inefficient that we could have eliminated the income tax for the year 2010, and for this year we could reduce it by about two-thirds, all else being equal. We have people who no longer can work and go on disability because we don't have a healthcare system to maintain people's health. It is a terrible system. And, of course, remember, even with the Affordable Care Act, which has been bringing down the cost of health care, even with the Affordable Care Act, we still have, I think it's about 35 million people with no health insurance. This is not a good thing. No other modern country does this. We're the only country in the world where people go bankrupt because of medical bills.
So, David, let me ask a question. How did we get here? How did it break? And then how did we get such an expensive system that's so inefficient? And how do we fix it? And can we fix it?
Well, we can fix anything we want, of course. That's the whole idea of our Constitution, is that we will solve our problems. Doesn't mean we will solve them, but we can solve them. Basically, in World War II, the government needed to suppress consumption, so we rationed things like meat and sugar and gasoline, but we also had to hold down wages to prevent inflation. So one of the things, Henry Kaiser, the guy who built, you know, those hundreds of quickly put together ships to move war material, persuaded the government to let him offer health care as a fringe benefit without it being in the tax system. And so then after the war, the Democrats took a look at the system of taxation and went, gee, now that we have this mass income tax, it's bringing in all this money, let's keep it. And they kept the health care system. Richard Nixon agreed to have universal health care in 1973. The AFL-CIO decided they could get an even better deal if they waited one more year, and of course Watergate came along and it never happened. The way out of this is, I think President Obama missed the opportunity, and that was to simply offer Medicare as an option at birth. And you could still have private insurance. Wouldn't interfere with if you want to have this expensive, inefficient system that's designed to deny you expensive care when you need it. And literally, as I report in my book, Free Lunch, bonuses doctors who say, refuse care to this person because they'll die and then we won't have to spend any more money on their health care. And there's testimony under oath about it I cite in my book, Free Lunch, from a doctor who says, you know, I shouldn't be getting bonuses for killing people. So, well, we can get out of this, but the way we've got to do it is to get away from this model of insurance and understand that this is just like kindergarten and public schools and highways. It is a commonly needed service, and the most efficient way to provide it is through universal care.
Well, we are chatting today with Mr. David K. Johnston, who is the author of Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And, David, we have just a couple minutes left. So if we expand Medicare to everyone and just do isn't that the single-payer system that there was so much discrepancy and so much discussion about?
Yes. Single-payer turns out to be the most efficient way to do it. There are other ways to do it. The Dutch, for example, use health insurance, but their model is quite different than ours, and it's universal. But denying health care to people is a very expensive process. It creates a lot of make-work jobs. It's the functional equivalent in health care of if we had construction sites where we banned earth-moving equipment and said everything has to be done with shovels. It's simply inefficient, and it leads to an awful lot of both early deaths and very costly early forced out of work because of disability.
Well, David, let me, in the minute or so we have left, let me have you talk about some of your past work. Talk about the Perfectly Legal book and that particular trilogy, and let the listeners know about it.
Well, Perfectly Legal was the first book in a trilogy about things you have never heard about the American economy. So it's about taxes. Free Lunch is about subsidies that go to very rich people, like Warren Buffett is one of the biggest recipients of welfare in America. And then the third book, The Fine Print, is about restraint of trade and monopolies, which is a way to drive up prices. Many Americans don't know that multinational corporations turn a profit on their taxes. They don't pay taxes. They turn a profit on them, and you and I pay them to defer paying their taxes. That the very wealthiest Americans pay very low taxes. In fact, I reported April 7th in my column for Al Jazeera America that the 400 highest tax returns went up 50% from 2011 to 2012, and their tax rate fell to 16.7%. If you're single and make $75,000 a year, there's a 1 in 5 chance you pay a higher tax rate than that. If you're single and make $100,000 a year, everybody pays a higher tax rate than these folks who made almost $1 million a day in 2012. So our system hits people in the upper middle class and then falls off. And when you get to the very, very top, the only income you have is incidental income. Warren Buffett had $64 million one year. It was from investments he had that were cashed out against his will, and he had to take the income. Very wealthy people borrow against their assets. These days, they pay as little as 2% and pay no taxes or only on incidental income.
Well, we're going to leave it there for this segment. You're listening to Everything Financial Radio. Our guest today is Mr. David K. Johnston, author of Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Sure, I'm glad you decided to join me today. You know, in this segment, I want to talk about a couple topics that you often hear about on the news and often hear about in economic news, but many folks are just not aware of exactly what these two things mean and, more importantly, how they might be affected when it comes to managing their nest egg. So in this segment, I want to talk about the topics of inflation and deflation, which might be around the corner and why, and more importantly, how might your nest egg be affected? How might your 401k be affected? And I want to start this segment by talking about the definition of inflation. Now, if I were to ask you what's the definition of inflation, or were to ask you to define inflation for me, many of you would probably say, well, that just means that prices are going up. Well, that's an effect or a symptom of inflation, but technically speaking, inflation is defined as an expansion of the money supply. Deflation is the polar opposite of inflation. So if inflation is an expansion of the money supply, then deflation is a contraction of the money supply. Well, how does the money supply expand? Well, we live under something called the fractional reserve banking system. And under the fractional reserve banking system, money is created when money moves. For example, if you were to go put money in your bank, say you went and deposited $10,000 in your bank, your banker would be required to reserve 10%. But the banker would be free to loan out the other 90%. And as that process continues and money moves, and the faster money moves, it's known as the faster the velocity of money is, the more money that's created. The other way that the money supply can expand is through money printing. Now, economists call money printing quantitative easing, and there's been quantitative easing programs that have taken place here in the United States. Europe is currently undergoing their version of a quantitative easing program, and under a paper currency system, money then is just printed out of thin air. Well, essentially, money today is not moving that much. The velocity of money is at or near an historic low. Now, how does the money supply contract? How does money disappear from the financial system? Well, the first thing to understand when you want to understand deflation is that more than 95% of money today is debt. When you think of money, you probably think of currency, but the reality is most money is not currency. Most money is debt. So how does this disappear from the financial system? Well, simply put, when the system reaches its capacity for debt, when the system can't handle any more debt, there's defaults on debt, and when folks default on debt, it means that money disappears from the financial system. And just to make it clear, let me give you an example. Let's say, hypothetically speaking, that I've got $50,000 in cash underneath my mattress. I then take that $50,000 in cash, and I loan it to a relative who needs to borrow money because she's lost her job, and she told me that she would give me her car for collateral. So I take the title to the car, I give her the $50,000 cash from under the mattress, and she tells me she's going to pay me back in 6 months. Well, I have a $50,000 asset in the form of cash under the mattress, but I also have a $50,000 asset in the form of a note that's payable to me. If I were to put together a personal balance sheet, my $50,000 asset is still on the balance sheet. It's just taken a different form. It's gone from cash to debt. And as I said, over 95% of money out there is debt. Well, now let's say this relative comes to me at the end of 6 months and says, I can't pay you. I thought I had a new job lined up. I thought my prospects were good. I turned out that they weren't good, that I don't have a job. I can't pay you back, so just keep the car. I take the car and I go sell it, and I get $20,000 for the car. My question to you is this: what happens to the other $30,000? I don't get it back. That money, as we say, went to money heaven. It's gone, and the money supply contracts. Whenever debt is not paid, Whenever debt is defaulted upon, the money supply contracts and you get deflation. Now, what these central banks around the world are trying to do by printing money is to add money to the system faster than money leaves the system through defaults. It's that simple. Trouble is, it doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't make the debt go away. I could look at the same out-of-work relative, and let's say instead of loaning money now, I say, you know what, I'll just go ahead and help you meet your monthly expenses for the next 6 months. I'll give you the money you need to meet your monthly expenses. Well, for 6 months, it seems like everything's fine. They've got cash or they've got liquidity. They're making their payments. Everything seems to be fine. But then in the seventh month, when I don't give them the cash, when they don't have the liquidity, they still have to deal with a debt that's there. So the important thing to remember is that in spite of all these programs that are designed to add liquidity to the system, they're designed to add cash to the system, the debt is still there. And sooner or later, you have to deal with the debt. And when you start to deal with the debt, we have deflation and we have the bursting of financial bubbles. Now, some of you may recognize the name David Stockman. David Stockman was the White House budget director under President Reagan. And there was an article published in which Mr. Stockman was quoted on April the 8th, 2015. And I want to give you just a bit from that article. David Stockman, White House budget director under President Reagan, has believed for some time that central banks' massive easing programs will end in catastrophe for global financial systems. And he's not backing down from those views now. Mr. Stockman is quoted as saying, "The worldwide central bank money printing spree of the last two decades has resulted in massive excess capacity and malinvestment all around the planet. The Federal Reserve has kept its federal funds rate target at a record low of 0% since December of 2008 and has inflated its balance sheet to $4.5 trillion through quantitative easing or, as we just discussed, money printing. What is coming, Mr. Stockman says, therefore, is not your father's inflationary spiral, because a lot of folks think that all this money printing will result in inflation, but an unprecedented and epic global deflation," Stockman states. So the central banks just keep printing, thereby inflating the asset bubbles worldwide. What ultimately stops today's new style central bank credit cycle, therefore, is the bursting of financial bubbles, he says. This has already happened twice this century, and a third proof of the case looks to be around the corner. And of course, many of you are aware that since the market bottom after the financial crisis in March of 2009, the S&P 500 index has tripled in value. So what are these bubbles? Well, in our view, and I agree with Mr. Stockman, I think that we're going to see, I think stocks are presently in a bubble, and I think U.S. Treasuries are presently in a bubble. If you look at the yield on a 30-year Treasury rate, it's still well under 3%, and the market is has tripled since the bottom in spite of a historically record-high trailing price-to-earnings ratio. So our advice is to be cautious. The what is a lot easier to predict than the when, but worldwide debt levels are high that we believe will lead to deflation in spite of what the central banks may try to do. And I would invite you to learn more about specific strategies you might use to protect yourself. We outline and discuss specific strategies in our Investors Discovery Kit. If you've not yet obtained your free copy, all you have to do to get one is go to the website investingapproach.com. Let us know your name and address and where to send the kit. We'll be glad to do that. When you receive your kit and open it up, you'll find inside a copy of the new Retirement Rules book released just several months ago, as well as a copy of the New Economy magazine and an educational CD and DVD. So again, the website, investingapproach.com.